Welcome to Chaotic Harmony. My name is John.
This is Crystal. We talk about the joys and the challenges of teaching music in the elementary school classroom.
We share struggles, we brainstorm solutions.
And we would love to have you join us.
Welcome to another episode of Chaotic Harmony, episode 107. I am your host today, Jonathan Seligman, and today I'm joined by a rather special guest. I say that every time, but it's true. She is everyone's auntie, Dr. Corinne Makapugai. Hello, Corinne. How are you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
Doing well. How's the week been?
It's been long and exhausting, I'll be honest. But hey, I'm alive. I'm healthy.
Cheers.
Cheers. Right, right.
Yeah, we were talking a little bit before the podcast, just the fact that, like, I don't know, you're just jumping around doing a lot of stuff. So I feel you. Also, how's it been that you're not Miss Mac or Professor Mac, but Dr. Makapugai? How's that shift been?
It's still surreal. It's funny. Every time I hear someone say it, I think, oh, who are they talking to? Oh, they're talking to me.
Gotcha.
But it's been a lot, you know, it's 3 years of your life that goes into it, much longer for most people. I already have a master's, so the doctorate program for me was much shorter, but I'm just so happy to be done.
Well, congratulations. Congratulations. You. And to our listeners, in case you don't know Dr. Corinne Makapugai, she is a professor in San Diego City College. She is extremely active in community work, which we'll get to more in a bit. But I'm not going to embarrass you, Corinne. Don't worry. There's a lot of accolades, which we'll probably put in the program notes because it extends from ocean to ocean. There's a lot of stuff. Check her CV. If you're skeptical, but there's no need to be. But honestly, the highest achievement that she's done, she's not only been a colleague with my mother, but also she is the proud mother of two kids that I have been able to work with. And honestly, both of them have been a delight. Also, it's been really weird. Your older child and was pre-COVID and your younger child is post-COVID. So I kind of have a little bit of a testing bed to see, like, what has worked and what hasn't worked. But both of them have been great.
Oh, fun. Yeah. I mean, just teaching. I've been framing the way I've been teaching and my teaching experience in that way too. Like, oh, pre-COVID, it was like this. And then during COVID, it was like this. And now we're in this funky post-lockdown type mode of teaching. It's been eye-opening.
This is not the main meat, but I'm just curious because as I've mentioned already to our listeners, like, Dr. Makapugai, you're in the colleges. So it's a very different kind of spiel. Just in two sentences or so, what have you noticed comparing pre-COVID to now, late/post-COVID, whatever we're in right now, like students that you've worked with, like, what's it like?
Pre-COVID, the first couple of weeks of the semester, I would have so many students trying to get into my classes that they would literally sit on the floor.
Oh, wow.
And hope for a seat to open. Yeah. I miss those days so much. We're very fortunate. Our college now, this year, our enrollment's actually back up to pre-COVID. Come. But that also includes online students. I still don't, for my program, it differs all over various disciplines. But for my program, I still don't have as many in person. My online classes are still, we're supposed to cap our classes at 40, 45. I have up to 50 for my online. But for my in-person, I maybe have like 25, 30.
Oh, wow. It's quite a shift. Okay.
It's a big shift. So just the way I do my lesson planning, the way I build out the curriculum, it's had to shift substantially.
Thank you. I appreciate that context. Well, anyways, we're going to get to a lot of the meat of this. I'm going to have thrown things off. But we'll get on to that. But once again, this is Chaotic Harmony, the podcast where we talk about the joys, the struggles, and all things adjacent to elementary music teaching. A bit of housekeeping. Last week, we had the great Miss Rodolyn Sese share her journey of pursuing the archetypical path of nursing to being an English teacher to eventually find herself at 8 different school sites teaching music. It's one of the more heartfelt episodes. And so you should definitely check that out after you listen to Corinne's episode here. Next week, we'll be having another Pilipine educator. The classy nerd himself, Genesis Santos, will be sharing his Genesis. So you won't want to miss that. Speaking of Genesis, he and the Arosa crew did a 2-part episode where we select the best video game music to be used in the classroom. But you have a job, listeners. Not only do you need to listen to it, but you need to cast your vote. Voting is in the show notes, so make sure your voice is heard and vote no to Jamie because her glide section's terrible. It is utterly terrible. Do a society a solid, y'all. And lastly, on March 10th, Crystal and I will be having our 100th episode celebration. Yes, episode 100. What happened a few episodes ago, but we'll be celebrating it then. And if you'd like to write in and have something read on air for that episode, email us at chaoticharmonyclassroom@gmail.com with the subject heading CH100. We'd love to read your memories, criticisms on air, especially if it's about Mark. We'll also have a special announcement, so you won't want to miss that. That all said, thank you for being patient, Corinne. Or Dr. Corinne. I want.
Right, not a thing. You're not my student. You're fine. We're friends.
I want to start out with what we like to call the program notes. Okay. Get to know you a little bit better before we get to the main attraction, the spicy stuff. So you grew up in San Diego, in the 619. Where did you go to school?
So I was born in the Philippines in Kalinga. Okay. Yes, I was born in Kalinga, but came over when I was barely even 2 years old. And the first neighborhood that we actually lived in San Diego was in Barrio Logan. Mm. So grew up in Barrio Logan. I attended Balboa Elementary. And then we moved over to where the other Filipinos are in Paradise Hills. So then I went to Penn, went to Bell. Back then it was still Bell Junior High. Mm. And then graduated from high school at Morse High.
Is it Bell Middle? What do they call it now?
Yeah, it's Bell Middle now.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, but back in my day, it was still junior high.
Back in my day.
I know. So when you quantify it, it feels like so long ago.
I was talking to my colleague who's like, when they were mentioning how old they are, it's, oh man, what? Like, you're that young, much younger? Oh no, am I the grandpa now?
Yes.
Not yet.
Just embrace it, Jonathan.
I'll feel it. Embrace it. So you went to Bell, you went, yep. And then for high school, where'd you go to?
Morse.
Oh, okay. So I'm not allowed to talk to you then.
Why? Where did you go?
I went to SCBA.
Oh, that's fine. Now, if you went to Lincoln.
Okay, fair enough.
You know, they didn't have SCBA yet.
It was O'Farrell, right?
Yes.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah,
yeah. It was only middle school or junior high. It wasn't high school yet either.
Okay.
When I was still in high school, yeah.
And then for university, where'd you go?
I went to Southwestern first, to community college, went in, and I love that the universe decided that I would be in community college again for my career. So I went to Southwestern Community College. I actually was accepted to other universities, but at the time, you know, the family financials didn't quite work out.
Of course.
Yeah. And the nice thing is that I actually took classes at Southwestern in the dual and concurrent enrollment program. So when I was still at Moores, I actually, like my senior year, I only had 4 classes and I would leave at lunch and then go do classes at Southwestern.
Mm.
So a lot of students don't know that. Actually, in Sweetwater, they're pretty good about it now. But when I graduated from Moores, I had a full semester of college credits to my name. Yeah. That's so cool. I went to Southwestern and then transferred over to San Diego State.
Mm, okay. And then the journey continued from there.
And then it just kept going.
Yeah, it did. Even to today. That's awesome. So our co-hosts have often talked about how California has been like an arts desert for a long time, where there hasn't been arts for a long time. If just for context, before I was hired here, there was no arts for 35 years until this huge renaissance. Were there arts in your school?
You know, the last time I remember having arts as part of the everyday curriculum was when I was in 4th grade, when we learned the flutophone.
Mm.
I know there's a difference between flutophones and recorders, right?
There are.
I remember it being called a flutophone. And then I did take violin after that, but that was private pay.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And you know, there was only, I only carried it on to maybe the end of 6th grade. But other than that, that was it. That's all that I, at least from my memory and all that I was exposed to.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, the flutophone is different, and it was funny because one of my students' parents emailed me, like, does this work? Because I teach recorders. She was like, well, it's not the same, and actually, correct me if I'm wrong, listeners, like, is that even, like, the right tuning system? I'm not sure. I think it's the correct one, but that would have been a different fingering. I am not sure, but yeah, it is different. It is different.
It is different, yeah. Mm-hmm. That's the last thing I remember.
So no arts except for the flutophone and then your own private studies.
Yeah, for music at least. There was, I do remember my junior year. My junior year, we did have painting, and that was part of the curriculum as an elective. But then
Gotcha.
that's it.
Yeah. So, but
Music-wise, it ended in fourth grade.
oof. So along the years then, like, what's like some of the biggest shifts that you've seen in San Diego?
Ooh, in what way? In education, in
I would,
politics, in society,
that's
in
actually, no, I opened myself into a can of worms here. I guess for me, since this is a music education podcast, like specifically like in realms of like how our city has seen the arts and valued the arts, not necessarily in schools, but just in general. What have you seen over the years?
Oh, that's a great question. So, we were just talking about how you went to SEPA. And SCPA opened up, I think it was still being built. It opened up right after I finished high school. And I remember thinking, wow, there's a whole school that emphasizes creativity and performing arts. Like it was such an incredible concept to me. And I remember thinking, like, how do they integrate, the general education and all of that? And it's funny, I think, because maybe back then, because there wasn't the term STEAM, right? Science, tech, engineering, arts, and math, that term didn't exist before. Even STEM didn't exist before. And so I don't think there were conversations around the necessity of having and teaching, not even just art specifically, but how do you integrate creativity in the way we educate students. I'm telling you, as a college professor now, it's a struggle sometimes. Having my students, and I tell them this all the time, I'm not here to teach you what to think. I'm here to teach you how to think. How can we process this information that I am, tasked with teaching you? How do you think about it? How do you see this content in the context of your communities? And so when, again, going back to your question of how arts education has changed, I think in San Diego County, for me, it's unfortunate that I didn't have much exposure to it. I love, and this is a big reason why we live in Chula Vista, because of VAPA, because the district here knew to invest in having the arts and creativity for our children. And, as much as I love Southeast and a lot of my community work and the majority of my family are still there, I really wanted my children in a district that had a program like VAPA.
I appreciate that. I appreciate that insight as a parent, and also, I mean, your kids are awesome. Your
Thank
kids are
you.
awesome.
Sometimes you know how they are.
Oh yeah, kids are kids, but like,
They're great
well,
with you.
specifically, well, I mean, their youngest is crazy in the best way.
Yeah, he
But
is. He's our honey badger, but I wouldn't change him for the world. He's awesome.
I still remember, this is online, when you posted a video of him, when he was in, I think, kindergarten still, him changing the words to
The
but to
fart
the toilet
in
version.
his butt. Yes.
Which is hilarious. Like, it just like, it, so it's just like, yeah, the fact that you really invest in creativity is evident. So thank you. I love your family. They're
Oh,
awesome.
thank you. Thank you.
So now you currently teach at City College. What is it you exactly teach?
So the program I head up and teach in is human services, and that includes social work, that includes community health, that also includes gerontology. So people who are wanting to work with our older populations, our folks in their golden years. And I also manage our conflict resolution courses as well.
What's that
That's
last,
all.
the elderly one? What's that called again?
Gerontology.
Gerontology. Okay, interesting. Never heard of that. Learn
Yeah. So
something
it's
new.
kind of like a, you probably have heard of geriatrics. Like that's another term that was used. So the term that we're using as a discipline is gerontology.
Gotcha. Okay. So did you always want to do this? Like, be a
No. Are
professor,
you
pursue
kidding me?
this?
No, teach. No, that was never ever in my higher education. No, it was never in my life plan. And I always laugh about it because the majority of my career, I did, funny enough, and I know we'll get to it, but I did actually work at Penn when I was in undergrad. Yes, I thought I was going to become a therapist. Okay, that was kind of my spiel. I wanted to become a counselor, something. I wanted to work with other kids who grew up the same way I did, right? So I wanted to get as much exposure to working with our youth as possible. So I actually did start off working for San Diego Unified. And then I also had worked through a program at San Diego State. I worked at the juvenile court schools, which I really love. Hmm. Love that population. I mean, they're like, just like the kids. They're just like me, the kids that yeah. I work with, you know? even though I did have some early experience in education, the majority of my career up until I started teaching has been in nonprofit work, all nonprofit work. That's where you know, I learned about community organizing and program development and sustainability and all that work.
Working with my mom.
Yes, working with your mom.
Yes.
You know, trying to keep our communities alive and well, you know, all that work, which is great because now I get to teach other people how to do that.
Okay.
So I was asked by a colleague at San Diego State in the Master's in Social Work program, which I also graduated from. So I received my Master's in Social Work in 2002. I received a call from one of my colleagues who said, girl, we need someone to teach this macro practice class, which is kind of like a community-based class. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the way we teach, it's a practice discipline, right? So you're teaching based on what you know, what you've seen, the realities of what life is like working in our communities. And I came and I taught it. Then I kept teaching. And then suddenly someone said, oh, there's a position at San Diego City College. They want a full-time person. You should try it out. And I thought, that's all my spiel. But I did anyway. And now...
You love it.
Like the best job I never thought.
That's awesome.
It is.
Is that common? Like those, because you, so if I understand correctly, you're someone who is boots on ground, who eventually ended up in the space where you were asked to, or where you felt the need to teach. And so you went from like boots on ground to teaching. Is that common in like the universities or colleges? No,
I don't think so. At least not in the college, not in the experiences that I've seen with my colleagues. Okay. Most people, and again, maybe because I teach social work though, if it was nursing, so typically we're under the same house as like nursing or health and human services, right? It is more of a practice-based discipline. But many of the colleagues that I have who are in higher ed, they kind of went to grad school, they did their doctorate, and now they've just kind of stayed in education. So you know, it's funny because my trajectory is not, I don't think it's typical. Okay. I didn't have to adjunct for a decade before finally getting a full time. Like I got it right off the bat. So I just think I'm really lucky.
It sounds like you weren't even a plan B teacher. You just ended up as a teacher.
Yeah. Like I really, it's so funny the way I operate at this point in life. Every morning I wake up and I just tell the universe, just put me wherever you need me today. You know, I'm tired. Just land me wherever. And I tell you, like having that attitude the past maybe decade of my life, this is where I am now. And it's been working out.
That's awesome. I mean, that kind of changes my next question I was going to go to. Because it seems like for you, the buck doesn't stop as being a professor. And it sounds like because you started with the framework, with the mindset that you wanted, like you were doing the groundwork already and just added teaching to it. And so, like, what is it then that propels you to do this much? Like, when you found your cushy job, like, I'm sure a lot of people could have just like, all right, I'm gonna let go. I'm a full-time mom. I'm a full-time teacher. But you're still very active. Like, I mean, just gonna throw some stuff to make you feel embarrassed. Present day civil rights one leader by Rise Magazine, civil leader of the year by Asian Pacific American Coalition. Like, and you found a lot of organizations, and you still seem like you are. What propels you to do so much work?
What a funny question. People ask me that all the time. And I really want to give you a really honest answer. Number one, I just love it. If we look at the state of the country right now, for example, it's really easy to fall into this pit of despair. You know, we're seeing so much work that so many of us who are educators, so much of the work that we've been doing kind of come to a pause, if not regress. Mm-hmm. So when I'm out in community, number one, that's what I teach, is how to be out in community. Part of what I teach is advocacy, is community organizing. And I believe that I'm able to teach it because I can inform my students in real time how our world is adjusting. Like literally this semester, because of all that's happening at the federal level, I am having to change my lessons every week. My lectures that I haven't had to touch really in 2 years, 2 to 3 years, I have to change them now every week because something is changing in laws and executive orders that literally affects the work that me and my students are going to have to do. Right. And so being so making sure that I'm connecting classroom to community is really important to me. And I tell my students that all the time too. You know, I can only give you so much in a textbook and what I write up here in a whiteboard and what I have in my Google Slides, but nothing can replace what it's like to be out on the streets, to have someone in front of you who's in crisis that you want to support. Like mm-hmm. that real-time boots on the ground work, nothing can replace that.
Sure.
So yeah. But yeah, and I just love it. I'm really extroverted. I need my times where I'm by myself and sure. I can just kind of starfish on the floor and wave. But no, it's what gives me joy and hope being out there and still feeling like I don't have to sit in this room full of despair, like nothing can change when I've seen change happen in our communities.
I like that. Yeah, I like the fact that it's almost like not cyclical, but it feeds itself. Like your teaching and your actions help you make the teaching more, not better, but like a better experience, but like more relevant. And then just also you're doing the groundwork that you always wanted to do. So you're constantly, okay. Yeah, so because like, I guess once again, we're just like, you've taken a very different path. And I find that the profession of education often lends itself to like for people who are perfect like you, like are perfectly, or like, teachers are perfectly natural community leaders. And, or at least it feels like it should be. However, in a lot of formalized institutions, personally, I see many who want to do more, but are bound by something else. Like they're focused on just the four walls. And this is not a shaming thing, by the way. Yeah, but like from my observation, this is more less of an individual problem and more like of a systemic problem where one feels bound by the institutions to create positive communities. I think, am I totally off?
I think you're right. And I do have to acknowledge that I think I'm fortunate because I'm in higher ed and I teach for a community college who takes great pride in being the social justice higher ed institution in San Diego County. Like that's a big source of pride for our president, Ricky Shabazz, who I have a lot of respect for. And that makes a difference in the way I can navigate the world. When I actually worked in the nonprofit spaces, I could not be this vocal because in the nonprofit world, a lot of the work I did was on sustaining programs and making sure that we had, you know, the mobile clinics to do outreach out in the street, making sure that we had our teen center to provide, health services to the students who were at the high school right across the street from our clinic.
Yeah.
And I could not risk like my social political stances, for example, I couldn't risk offending a potential donor.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So in that space, I had to be much more strategic about making sure that what I was conveying was aligning with the mission of the organizations I was working in. Whereas in higher ed, because I teach social work, in social work, our values literally include diversity, social justice, the dignity and worth of the human being. So it's not just, Dr. Max spouting the stuff out of my mouth.
Right.
These are literally like the values and the curriculum approved by the Council on Social Work Education that I teach to my students. So I'm in a very fortunate space that I can practice my value of social justice so openly because I teach it.
Yeah. But I mean, I don't know. I know there's multiple strains of thoughts on what music education should be or shouldn't be. And I'm sure like there are probably different perspectives of what social work and the things that you teach should and shouldn't be. But I, for me, my perspective is like when you teach music, you're teaching about having a student's voice, then the voices are diverse. And there are going to be ways you need to include students who are of different needs. And there is still that apprehension, I find, of a lot of teachers. And again, this is not a shaming thing, but there is something that binds us to like be able to speak and be community leaders, not just teach important lessons, but to outreach to the community and create a positive community. And like, for you mentioned earlier that like for the nonprofit space, it's the money. Do you think, as a conjecture, do you think that's possibly the same thing for non-higher ed, for other educational systems? Money, is it always money or is it something else?
Is it always just money, or do you mean in spaces where maybe we can't be as vocal?
Yeah, or we can't do as much, or like, yeah, I guess it goes back to my question. It's like, what is it that like inhibit? Why do you think that it's always hard for educators to create positive communities as opposed to just focusing on just the four walls, like going beyond just the classroom but being community leaders specifically?
Why is it so? That's right. So when I was talking about my position in being in higher ed, I do think it's more difficult for K-12. I do really think it's much more difficult for the folks in K-12 because you also have parents to contend with, right?
Sure.
My students are 18 and up, right? If they have an issue, they're just going to come to
they're
me.
Adults. So yeah.
Their mommy's not going to come. I actually
well,
didn't.
Have you?
She's grown. She can handle this. So it's that experience is so different. And I do feel like, and I don't blame administrators. If I am a K-12 school administrator, the last thing I want is to have to deal with angry parents who are upset because I am trying to teach their child about reproductive health. Right?
Right.
At the same time, well, and you can opt out of it anyway. Parents do have the option of opting out, right? So
sure.
it's so different. And I could see where the fear and the apprehension of having to defend teaching can really weigh down on people. I think what also prohibits too is, having to show why this lesson plan is effective. Mm-hmm. There are things, you know, as an educator that benefit students, right?
Yeah.
Okay, let's talk about music. Let's talk about scientifically, I wrote articles on this. Scientifically, we know when children are in school, it's like, let's say children who are new immigrants, right? Mm-hmm. The number one place for acculturation starts in schools.
That's Can you first- define acculturation?
Acculturation.
Yeah.
So if you're new to a country or you're mm-hmm. new to a community or new to a society, right? And you come from a very different society, how do you learn about this new society that you're in, this new community that you're in? For children, that first place is going to be a lot of the times in the schools. Learning how to speak English. There's a reason why we have ESL, right? Learning, learning how to sit still in a room with 25 other kids. And
they don't learn that though.
Yeah, they don't do that. I know, right? But one of the things that we do know as educators, and what the science tells us, is that if you help affirm a child or an adult, anyone, any student, if you help affirm a person's identity, mm-hmm. and that means if they do hear a song that their grandma also sings at home, that now they and their 29 other classmates are learning, what that does to a child and their sense of belonging and affirmation and identity of self has literally been documented. That's a positive thing. We now know that if we teach children multiple languages, it's not just good for identity and culture, it's good for their brain.
Yeah.
They're expanding. I mean, so, you know, it's really frustrating when the practices aren't matching the science. Mm-hmm. And when the science itself is not being heeded, when the science benefits our students, we want children to become adults who are well-rounded, who are empathetic, you know, who are right and sure in themselves mm-hmm. so that they can treat other people with dignity and respect. And that all has to do with being accepting of diversity, being accepting of different cultures, learning the music, learning the dance of other people. It's not just learning one very rigid definition of what it means to live in this country. But we are literally living in times where teachers are being told what to teach and what not to teach.
So do you feel like some things that bind us down, back to the the initial question was like that it's the apprehension to constantly defend the things that you're sharing. It's the apprehension of losing the positions just because you know what the truth is, but like it's, but like, do you think like it's the apprehension of just it falling apart and constantly
I
fighting?
think it's part of that. And I'm sorry, no, I always digress on that because my brain thinks 10 different directions all the time. But your question though did also ask about, you know, teachers. How can teachers become community leaders? Because like you said, you know, it's funny, in my 20 years of community organizing, I realized I was effective because I was really good at communicating and teaching people about the issues that are affecting our communities. You can't connect with someone if you're not communicating and understanding how they're going to be impacted, or the people that they love are going to be impacted by the things that you're trying to organize for, right? And so I realized that education has always been part of my world, even if I never had the for if even if I wasn't formally teacher or professor at the time, I've always been educating. Like you, we were always educating, right? Like right now, you and I are educating each other, and then listeners that you're going to have here. But I also think, again, and from the moments that I did work in K through 12, it's just exhausting. I don't know if I had to be in a room with like 30 fifth graders, like day in and out. I don't know that, and I have kids of my own. I don't know that I would have much energy for anything else, Jonathan. You know what I mean? I just think a lot, our teachers are really tired. You know, I have a lot of K through 12 teacher friends, and by the end of the day, they're just like, they're just done. You know, how am I going to bring them out to a town hall or a forum when they're just so tired?
And you mentioned something though that I found was really pertinent though, like the communicating. Like I remember, I forgot who said it. I remember before I deleted the app on TikTok, before I deleted TikTok, like one of like the person people I followed, he was mentioning how it's not enough just to be right. It's like you gotta be able to communicate, and I feel like that's one of the hardest things. Like when the rubber hits the road and like they just aren't getting it, even though you know what the correct answer is, it's like they just aren't getting it. And so like I mentioned that because like I don't know, community organizing is something that I've always strived to do kind of in my own way. But it's hard to get people to follow. It's so hard to get people to follow. And have you? What have you found as like the most effective ways to organize? And I guess like I guess when I'm talking about all the questions I've mentioned so far, I'm kind of going in and out of the classroom. I guess right now I'm focusing mostly on now parents or other educators.
How can we move other educators?
How can we move other educators to like girdle their loins and like, you know, push forward to push for a cause, whether it is, hey, let's organize to make sure that we have decent pay, or that the union listens to our segment of the of our teaching profession, or just et cetera. There's so many things that we organize or desire to organize for. Like, So like, I forget what my initial question was. How do you move them?
How do you move them? No.
What has been what have you seen?
So there's different ways, right? And you're asking about for teachers. Okay. And it's really interesting because I had one of my children's former teachers before was very much on the opposite end of the political spectrum from me and my beliefs, right? But they were a good teacher, and what was it? We were in a conversation and they said something about a liberal agenda. And but in the next vein, they were also talking about making sure that they work alongside other teachers, because it was a time when they were when the union was really asking for pay. And so when it comes to something like that, right, we have to be able to communicate how that person's going to be impacted. If you want to be able to teach, number one, do you still want to keep your job? Like, you know what I mean?
True.
And this is not going to be the same case in every situation, right? You really have to take the time. So as an organizer, you really have to study the syllabus. You really have to take the time to go, okay, what is the issue here? How are these people being impacted? How can I communicate that impact to them in a way that they're going to get right away? So, you know, if I'm going to move a bunch of teachers over salary and pay, it could literally just start with that. Like, hey, you've been teaching for 30 years, but did you know that your job could be at risk because XYZ is just about to happen? I'm not sure if you knew that. Or, you know, you've been on this pay scale for a certain amount of time. This other legislation is coming down the road that might affect your ability to be promoted or your ability to, you know, get COBRA or whatever it is, and really just hone in on how that person's life is going to be impacted. You want to keep your job? Do you want to be able to keep the pay that you've been working so hard to get all this time? You know, and in that kind of like union worker organizing, that kind of rhetoric tends to pretty much do well. Not only can you take care of yourself, but how can we also stand up for our other colleagues that have had your back and that you co-plan lessons with and everything? Like, how do we collectively come together as educators and people who love to educate and people who care about our kids? How can we come together to make sure that we have the right people in our classrooms to educate our kids?
Finding common ground, it seems like.
Exactly. Common ground. But then also, like, how is your life going to be impacted? Like, how is that teacher's life going to be impacted if they don't show up at this meeting? Or if they do show up at this meeting, right? And a lot of times it's that. Now, if it's something else, like outside of the school, then that can differ.
Sure.
So, you know, like, say, like here in the community of Chula Vista, right? We might have teachers who don't necessarily live here, but the kids here might be severely impacted by something that, you know, that could impact the city of Chula Vista, but you might have teachers who don't live here anyway. So their own lives may not be impacted, but if they're people who really do care about the communities they serve. Now, again, there's an assumption that these are people who really do care about the communities they serve, and being able to let them know, like, look, this thing's about to happen. If this happens, you know, 20% of our kids might not be able to come to this school anymore. Or, you know, 10% of our kids might come home and find that their parents have been deported. Mm-hmm. And then they're going to end up in child welfare system. So you've got to find what they care about. If it's their livelihood, if it's their own family, if it's the kids that we're teaching, if it's our colleagues, you got to find where people's hearts lie. It's really easy to not piss people off, but it's really easy to come at it from a narrative of anger.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that's what a lot of organizers, a lot of like conflict organizers do, which can get, that can rally people up for sure, but you get burnt out real quick.
Yeah. And it feels like the fuel burns up quickly. Even if you don't burn out quick, like the desire to keep on pushing, just like, okay, never mind. I want to focus on what sustains me. Like, and so yeah, anger is a good initial fuel, but doesn't keep the fires burning. It seems like,
it'll be really strong in the beginning, but it's just really difficult to hold on to negative emotions over a sustained period of time.
But I feel like a lot of people are used to that, especially with social media. It's just like anger, just like, it's easy to just post an angry post, but like to actually listen and hear what the other side wants is, it takes you to, again, I've shared this a lot on the podcast, but I find one of the things about teachers that we focus too much on our four walls, and we really do need to step outside and talk to other teachers. And it seems like that's what you're sharing here. You need to actually listen to what these teachers or parents or et cetera, what really motivates them. And let's just take the topic of arts education. If arts education is being, if it's in jeopardy, then we need to find what is going to make these teachers or these parents to join your side, to join your cause. What's going to make them, convince them?
And to keep it.
Yeah.
Well, and the reality is that the things that happen outside of our classrooms and our class Zooms will affect your classroom, whether you like it or not. We can't, you know, we can't only focus on what happens in our four walls, because everything that happens outside, like if a kid shows up to your class and they haven't ate yet because they're living in poverty, or they're sleeping, their whole family sleeping under the car, is that kid going to be able to pay attention in your class? No. And now you're going to have to use up your energy to help care for this kid. So what happens outside of the four walls does affect what happens inside of your four walls. And we just can't deny that.
Yeah.
Now, you know, again, interestingly enough, I am trained as a social worker, right? And that's what I teach. And I do feel for a lot of teachers because they don't have that training, but then they're the ones a lot of the time who can see what the issues are. They're the ones who can tell when this kid is having a good day or a bad day. Because you're, for a lot of teachers, and this is something I want teachers to also keep in mind too, for a lot of our students, that's the only safe place they have is in classroom. You know what I mean? And that's, it's a tough reality that none of us like to admit. But for a lot of kids, especially in certain neighborhoods, those 8 hours in your classroom might be the only safe space they have.
I find that we've slowly created a list of things that we wish we were taught in our studies to be a teacher. And you're right. That's definitely, if it's touched on, it's only touched on and it's not really dug deep into. And there's just so much for teachers to learn. So I get it. But like, man, like this, that's, it's super important. That is a whole podcast in itself. Actually, so I want to kind of change lanes for a second. Yeah. It's not really fully change lanes because we've been talking about it, kind of maybe circumventing the topic. But still having our community organizing hat on. I mentioned California has been kind of a desert for arts education for a long time. And due to a lot of factors, there will be cuts against the arts coming soon. That is a fact, sadly enough. From both the parent perspective and a social work perspective. First off, let's just start from the first question. I feel like you've answered this, but just to consolidate it, do you find value in the arts?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we haven't gotten to it yet, but mm-hmm. I'm a cultural practitioner myself. I grew up around music and dance. It's such from my Kalinga indigenous culture from the Philippines, like those are rites of passage and rituals that like the music and the dance and the clothing and the texture of the clothing, even the way we wear our clothing, the foot movements, the hand, all of these little things are rife with symbolism and importance. And so for me, that's what I grew up with. And I mean, honestly, and I appreciate you reading off some of the accolades that I've been so blessed to receive. But what I want folks to know is that what that means is that many times throughout my life, I've been the only person in a room who looks like me. You know, I have been the only person of color or the only woman or the only woman of color all the time. And I'm just not like, when that happens, I'm just not like the other people in the room. And I remember feeling like, oh my gosh, how can I ever relate or be similar? And the truth is that I won't. And I'm not trying to anymore. Mm-hmm. Who I am is a strength. I don't have to have had the same exact experiences as people, but I'm very confident in who I am as a person. And I would not be the same if I did not have the cultural and artistic practices that I was blessed to grow up with.
If I can ask once again, just to kind of sort it.
Yeah, no, I'll do it.
You know, to make it real worthy. What is the, like what for you as a parent and from an organizer's perspective, what is the value of the arts?
Oh my gosh. It affirms who we are as people. Now, when we say the arts, that's such a huge umbrella, right?
Certainly.
We're talking about music, playing the music, or even just listening and appreciating the music, movies, film. You know, I was a photographer for a bit too with my husband. You know, I grew up dancing. I grew up playing instruments. The value of all of that is it's not just making you a well-rounded person. We also know that there are correlations between the arts and your sense of well-being and your sense of who you are. I'm working with a group right now, Tapu Samoa, and they host these Samoan arts practices in spaces where they're also advocating for wellness. and how that's related.
Mm.
Because we know that, and I know my brain keeps going back to the cultural arts, cultural specific arts that I grew up with, right? Gong playing, the dances that my parents and my grandparents taught me. Again, all of that for me helped for me to define my sense of identity and my sense of place in this world. And my sense that even though my artistic expressions are very different from someone else, that's a beautiful thing. That diversity, that that saying, oh, this is how, this is the music and the dance that I grew up with. How about you? Like, my oldest, whom you also taught, plays mariachi music. And I love that. I love that my Filipino child gets to play mariachi, that we're in the space where he gets to learn that and gets to practice playing mariachi, because 80% of my neighbors are Mexican. And so to be able to learn someone else, you know, having the privilege of learning someone else's culture like that, I mean, it's a beautiful thing. And to do that in a space that's safe.
Yeah.
You know,
it's a way. Sorry.
Okay.
Yeah, it seems like it's a way to almost like share culture. It's a way to see someone else and see yourself. It's a way to just see people. I like that. I like that.
Even be a person. Like, it's identity affirming.
Mm-hmm.
And it can differ. I have one of my really good friends loves to talk about the significance of hip hop and what that means for Black African American youth, right? Built into their culture. And having that again as a strength, having something that you could say, oh, that came from my people, right? This beauty, this thing that we enjoy. During COVID, when I was teaching online for the first time, I never taught online before, but I had to teach online during lockdown. One of the things that I would ask my students is to tell me about an album or a movie or a book that's been sustaining you. And it was like the best question. Everybody had something to say. Because when you're by yourself, literally, you can't get anywhere, right? A lot of the time, it's the arts that keeps you company. It's the arts that reminds you that you're human and that we are capable of creating these beautiful things. You don't have to speak. I don't speak Spanish fully to appreciate the music that my son is playing. You know what I mean?
I know. Yes, definitely. Definitely. And thankfully, like, you're someone who... I'm talking to someone who has great value, who represents, not represents, who appreciates, who understands it. And I feel like there's a lot of people who don't. And so to pivot to my final big question for today, like, as many of us, back to this notion of the arts being cut, sadly, as many of us feel there's this need to do something regarding the institutions that we belong to defend the arts, how do you recommend we educators, how do we address these cuts? We as teachers often get into the same cycles of what view is correct. As I mentioned to you earlier, like this is the correct way, but like communicating is the key thing. From your perspective as a staunch advocate of the arts, how do you feel like we as teachers need to get out of our blinders and address this problem so that our local communities can join our fight for the arts?
Okay, this is the angle that I like to win, because
in
higher ed, we're also talking about why we need the humanities still, right? Why do you still need to appreciate reading and writing, for goodness sake, right? If the United States is going to keep up with the rest of the world and its global economy, and we're going to still be competitors and have... I don't want to just call it a workforce. If we're going to be able to have people who really are the best talented, if we're going to have the most knowledgeable people, if we're going to have the most creative people in the world, like we claim to have, how can you do that if you are not teaching creativity? If you are not integrating the arts into curriculums? I mean, tell me any engineer who didn't learn how to draw a straight line without an art class. You know what I mean? How can you show me a physician who can do precise surgery without learning how to see colors and lines and tell how blood looks a certain way in a body if they didn't take an art class. You know, how can you communicate well? How can you speak what you're thinking and speak what's on your mind if you didn't listen to music or think about how powerful words can be? I mean, words can move a world, right?
Oh, yeah.
And how do you do that if you haven't learned the arts? So if we're going to be able to compete with the rest of the world, and if we're really going to keep this country ready to compete with the rest of the world, we have to have the most holistic education as possible. Period. That, I mean, that's one way to look at it. I don't mean to say that we should have the arts just for economic sake. At the same time, how do you have humans that care about each other?
That's a hard question.
How do you interpret beauty? How do you be moved? I mean, it's funny, you know, some people always have triggers, memory triggers for some people. Seeing something, it's a smell. For me, it's a song. I don't know what I did yesterday, but I can tell you the lyrics to music that I heard 30 years ago. You know what I mean? And there's a reason why. Yeah.
What lyrics did you hear 30 years ago? Hit me up.
they're not safe for work. Podcast. You can hear the music. I don't know. Fair. I have decent taste in music, but there's something about that. There's that wiring in the brain. There's knowing rhythms. And anyway, I don't know how we can be fully realized human beings if we don't have the arts being taught to us in school. And I for my educators, you all to advocate for that, it's tough, right? But okay, we're code switching all the time, right? We're having to speak certain languages. And so the hard part though is I would say, okay, well, show the impact, right? Let's do comparisons of scores and grades of children who did have programs like BAPA and students who did not. And how do we compare them? How do we compare also their career trajectories and things like that, right? Like if you want to get nitty gritty, you have to be able to show impact. And that's tough to do because how many professions have to show impact, right? You just know that it's working. You know that it's benefiting people.
And also just like, how do you get into the nuance of that? Like, how do you get into, because A, it equals, you know, A transfers to B. It's like, it doesn't, but it does. It helps influence, but like, to state that because they have VAPA, they are improving in test scores is, you know,
it's difficult.
It's messy. Everything, like, all data is messy. Like all this stuff is messy. It's not easy, but people want an easy answer. People want their eggs to cost $1. But like in the end, it's a messy, complicated mess of situations. Like the reason why things are what they are. And so, but I you're right. Like that's definitely been like a huge push for a lot of advocates. Thankfully, they're doing the Lord's work of doing, they aren't exactly in schools, but they're trying to coalesce data to showcase, hey, we need it. But,
but you know what, though? You hit it on the nail, too. And again, I'm speaking as someone who used to have to write grants and things like that. I know the kind of the language that certain people are looking for, but you're right. That's not a language that we should even have to speak.
It isn't.
Why do I have to defend that I don't want my child to grow up and be a jerk? Like, I have to defend that. I have to show you the pie chart for that.
How it affects the GDP, you know?
I know. I have to. Exactly. See? And you're right. Because we're not. Because those are people who didn't grow up with arts, Jonathan. People did not grow up without the art. They did not have this. I mean, it's defending completely different things.
And also, like, what strain of art? Because I know there are areas in the United States that have strong arts programs, but that area values different things. And so, like, what specific, like, to talk, as you mentioned earlier, to talk about art is so broad. Like, what specifically about art? Like our elitist form of art? Or are we talking about, you know, deep, you know, grassroots art? Like, yeah. Oh, man. But I feel like we could talk about this like for many, many episodes, but I do appreciate you sharing from, maybe it's not the parent perspective because we can't, you know, parents aren't a monolith, like, you know, like, but you can at least, I hearing from you that I'm not crazy, that
you're
like,
not crazy.
Thank you. But like, or that my arts educators aren't, you know, what's the term? What's the term that's been really, well, we don't have our blinders on. We aren't just like seeing it, but like parents also see the importance of arts. Parents like you see the importance of arts. And so I appreciate you sharing and coalescing and talking about why you value the arts. And I hope we as educators can lean into that somehow.
You know what, if anything, even though it's hard to pull that quantitative data, here's, okay, when we're talking about communications, right? And storytelling and things like that. There's a reason there are certain people in certain spheres of influence. It doesn't matter that they're actually very wrong, right? They're not giving out accurate information. They're not giving out the correct data, but they know what to say because, again, ironically, they're actually being very artistic in the way that they're speaking because they're using words that they know people react to, right? So you as an educator, I think one of the things, you know, for me, one of the things that I do is when my students always share with me the impact of what they've learned in the classroom, I save that. That there is value to that qualitative data, to having a student say, look, I'm a physician now. I don't know. I'm an engineer, whatever it is that they are now. But growing up, my favorite class was Mr. Seligman's class. And when I got to learn choir at the end, you know, after school, it's rare that people are going to say, oh, my favorite class was, at least for me, and no knock on the math teachers, but I'm not ever going to be like, oh, my favorite class is math, right? Like,
to each their own, but also, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, again, being able to like hold on to those stories too, mm-hmm. of those students and those students who will grow up to be those advocates.
I like soon. That. I like yeah. that. I feel like
hold on to that.
Looking in the opposite direction, that is why I mentioned there's a lot of people who focus on the quantitative data. I think as storytellers, which is what we are people who try to encourage people to be storytellers through music, through art, through dance, we need to really lean into how do we collect, maybe not numbers, but collect our stories as means. I like that.
You should keep that. I mean, like your podcast, right? All of these are recorded. I think every time you... This is why I'm big on saving emails and communications and little stories from my students too, because sometimes one student's story is so much more powerful than any quantitative data table I can show you. And again, that's because of the arts and the emotions that it conveys to people, right? So let's lean into that.
Fantastic.
Well, be an artist. This is what you do.
Thank you, Corinne. I think that's a lot. And there's, again, we can talk more, but maybe we'll just have you again for another time. Thank you so much, Kirin.
Anytime, just holler.
Of course. We'll get more in a bit, but well, first off, we have a break.
I want to take a quick break and thank my husband, Brian, who's been working behind the scenes producing these episodes every week on all of the platforms and on time. But you need to know that he is first a financial planner for Mission Trails Financial. Mission Trails Financial is a partner that seeks to guide clients in the journey to financial success. They believe that people need a financial advisor that aims to provide strategies for success. Mission Trails Financial helps people navigate investments, tax planning, and insurance. Imagine working with an advisor who isn't tied to specific brands. Mission Trails Financial has a fiduciary responsibility to act in the best interests of their clients by providing independent, objective advice. Their mission is to help clients accomplish their financial goals. As Joe Vitale once said, a goal should scare you a little and excite you a lot. Do yourself a favor and set up a time to chat with Mission Trails Financial. Visit www.missiontrailsfinancial.com or call 619-419-0238 to schedule a call. You'll be glad you did. We believe that leaning on professionals is how we get ahead. Check out the program notes for more information.
Welcome back from the break. But before we continue, a hard left turn. And this is for our listeners. Kirin, you can just chill. thank you all so much for being a part of this 100 plus episode journey, whether you joined us back in episode 0 with Lauren Shelton or you're here for the first time, thank you so much. If you've enjoyed what you've heard, please support the things you love. We have a Patreon, patreon.com/chclassroom, where you can get special merch and other things for the class. But if you don't have a buck to toss our way, that's okay, because ideas are meant to be free. And also, especially during these economic times, I get it. So, but there are free ways to support us. Leave us a review on Spotify or Apple Podcasts. Tell your students, all your students, to leave a review. Like, just before they leave the classroom, like, have them pull out their phones. You know they have their phones out. Just have them, you know, send reviews, you know? And also, we only count to five. There's only five stars. Five is the only number I understand. So just five stars, please. And if you leave a written review, I will on air do a non-locomotor dance for you. A lot. Follow us also on YouTube and the socials. Leave this episode a like. Write a nice comment. All these things, all these small things, are ways to ensure that these extracurricular things that we do still exist and don't get bought out by Microsoft or Ask Jeeves. So, deeply appreciated. That all said, today we're doing our classic spiccato, which is where we do a rapid fire set of questions. Kirin, are you ready?
Sure.
Okay. First off, is cereal a soup?
No.
Why did I have you on this podcast? Never mind.
You mean like the milk after? That's, you know, cereal is cereal.
Let's recontextualize. What is? Art, man. Art. Okay, moving on. What is your go-to karaoke song?
Oh my God. Someone just asked me that. Okay. I did not inherit the Filipina singing talent. Okay. Yeah. I am not a singer. I will happily be the moral support and the background dancer and the cackler in the background. I am not a singer, but if I was forced to, I think it would totally be a Journey song. I don't know what song.
You just know.
I'm so bad with titles, Jonathan.
Like the big one, Don't Stop Believing?
Okay.
There we have it. It's on air, you know. Okay, doing the PG version of this question. Marry, kiss, kill. You know, the what would you marry? What would you kiss? Is the PG version?
And then what would I kill? Oh my God.
Yeah. So what would you marry, kiss, kill? Rice, noodles, and bread.
Oh. I have to marry rice. I would kiss bread and kill noodles. I can live without noodles. Yes, right?
Okay. I said it. I am the controversial one where I would kill rice. I know, but bread's so diverse. I would marry bread. I would kiss the noodles and kiss goodbye to rice. If I had to.
But you know, you can make rice into like mochi, and like there's so much you could do with rice.
I know.
It doesn't have to stay like rice.
This is true. Maybe I should recontextualize. Maybe I should rethink.
Rice is potential.
Yes, exactly.
Worker, you know, we fall in love with potential, unfortunately.
Back to the music topics. What is the best song written in the past 100 years?
Oh my gosh. Okay, it's not like the best song by standards, but the most important song for me. Oh, that's a hard one, Jonathan. It's like when people ask me my favorite songs, I can't. It's so hard.
And I don't want the Oscars here. I want to thank this. I want to thank. No. Just.
You know, it's not, I really love Kendrick Lamar's All Right.
All Right. Okay.
I do.
For me, my favorite Kendrick Lamar piece is Mother, I Sober. That one just hits hard, and it's so different from like his other works. Like I tear up every now and then whenever
every time that. Right, yeah, you can't just, even like the whole Mr. Morale album carried me through pandemic.
That was my first Kendrick Lamar album, actually, like whole, like from
the
beginning
whole
to end.
Thing, yeah, it's so good.
Yes. It's the reason why your youngest loves Kendrick. Awesome. Kirin, thank you so much for this. Do you have anything that you would like to plug? Anything coming up? Any article you're writing or such?
I mean,
this will be released next week, by the way. So, what's up?
Oh, it is? It's being released next week?
Yeah.
No, I think, you know, for anyone who's listening, what I've been telling a lot of people is just, I know there's so much going on in the country. Just don't fall into despair. You know, don't fall into freeze mode. Don't lose hope. I was at High Tech High earlier. I was talking to two classes of ninth graders, and they had even asked me the same thing. They said, "Why? How do you stay, and how do you stay optimistic still and hopeful in the work that you do?" And I tell them, like, honestly, like, you and I were educators, right? I honestly feel like our students, even from the younger ones to my 60, 70-year-old students, they are the reason I have hope. Because yeah. they all just want to do something good, right? So as long as we have people like that who still care, people who love the arts, and people who love people, we'll be all right.
I love how your plug is shouting out people. Appreciate you. And if people want to reach out to you, is there a way people can reach out to you? Like either through email or on the socials, whatever.
Yeah. So I am, oh my God, what is it? I am on Instagram. I am Professor Corinne Mack. Is that who I am? Yes, I am Professor Corinne Mack. And I do have also a website, corinnemack.com. You can email me there. And yeah, I like connecting with people. So keep up the good work yourself, Jonathan. Thank you also for educating both of my kids. They're
yes.
very different personalities. As
very
you know.
Different.
But you've taught them both so
they're
well.
Awesome nonetheless. Thank you, Corinne. And also, if you wish to contact us, you can find me on the socials at Mr. Seligman, MrSeligman. Also, for us, the Chaotic Harmony Classroom. For Chaotic Harmony, you can reach us at CH Classroom. Corinne, it's been an absolute pleasure. You are a very different kind of person that we interview, but it was still extremely valuable. So thank you for spending your afternoon to chat with me.
Oh, thank you.
All right, all y'all. Bye.
Bye.
The Chaotic Harmony Podcast is a joint project between Crystal Pridmore and Jonathan Seligman. You can find us online at chaoticharmonyclassroom.com. You can email us at chaoticharmonyclassroom@gmail.com and let us know what you think. Give us feedback about what you would like to hear in future episodes. We're on all the socials. Find us on facebook.com/chaoticharmonyclassroom. You can find us on Twitter at chclassroom, Instagram at chaoticharmonyclassroom, and you can even find our episodes on YouTube. Chaotic Harmony is the name of our channel. Special thanks to Brian Pridmore for his help with production and equipment. www.pridmoria.com.
I feel like as I'm getting older, I'm undiagnosed ADHD. And so like,
totally.
And it was funny because growing up, it's like, I felt like my mom was like, "Mom, you're undiagnosed ADHD." And as I got older, I was like, "Oh, wait, it's me too."